The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to Too Jewish with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Sarah Bloomfield, director of the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com. We'll also have visits with our maven on Israel, Danny Bobman, and our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and hear a new story from the Too Jewish Summer Stories Contest. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's fastest-growing synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. We're sponsored as well by Jill Rich of Realty Executives, by Environmental Strategies, by Handmaker Jewish Services, and by Yanos Restaurant and the J-Bar. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. We have now officially passed the Jewish fall holiday season, which began with Slichot back on September 11th and concluded with Simchat Torah at the tail end of last week. As wonderful as these holidays are, there's no way to quite capture the relief that rabbis and cantors feel at the conclusion of the fall extravaganza season. Picture an accountant the day after April 15th, combined with a retail store owner on December 26th, wrapped up with a fireworks salesman on July 5th, and you begin to get some idea. It's a great time of year, but the crush of events, people, and interesting and complex rituals makes this the highest pressure period of the entire Jewish calendar year. But that's all history now. We can relax, start eating bonbons, and luxuriate in a fall season that includes not one single festival. In fact, the Jewish month that begins this Saturday is nicknamed Mar Cheshvan, the bitter month, because it lacks even a single holiday. But here in the Southwest, it does have the best weather, and more importantly, some of the best Torah portions of the whole year. Yesterday's portion was Bereishit, the tale of the creation of the world, including the Garden of Eden and the early prehistory of humanity, Cain and Abel, and so on. But this week we get the ultimate sea story and the first great boat builder and navigator, Noah. We're mostly familiar with the text of Noah itself. God sees that wickedness and corruption have spread throughout the world, and that human beings are acting in ways that should have been predictable to an all-knowing deity. Lying, cheating, stealing, committing adultery, giving war contracts to cronies in the oil business, you know, all the usual. In response, God decides to destroy the world in a great flood, rain falling for 40 days and nights, and the whole of humanity drowned in the deluge. One man is chosen to survive the flood because the Torah text tells us in this week's portion, he was righteous in his generation. Noah, Noach in Hebrew, is chosen to carry the banner of humanity to the next generation. Gathering his family about him and two of each animal, plus seven pairs of each kosher animal, so there's something to eat and something else to sacrifice to God if they make it out, Noah builds the ark, loads the boat, and goes on not a three-hour cruise, but one long enough to float away every trace of the depravity of humanity in those early days. Eventually, he sends out first a raven and finally a dove to see if the world is dry enough to land on. The dove brings back that famous olive branch. They land and exit the ark, and life begins again. Noah, we're told, was a righteous man in his generation, which doesn't necessarily make him a righteous man in every generation. But it certainly does make him a wonderful subject for comedians in every generation. Here's David Steinberg's exploration of Noah's character.
Noah! Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, all three of whom had an IQ totaling 70. The Bible states explicitly that Noah was a righteous man in his generation. The Bible does not add words. Why do they say in his generation? Because we find out later on in Genesis that Noah liked to drink. He was, in fact, a drunk. The Bible states it clearly. Later on, Clifford Odets backs it up. My contention is this. If you had to live on a boat 10,000 mating hippopotami. And those three sons for conversation. You too would be righteous only in your generation.
I've always liked Noah, both for his stolidity in the face of overwhelming disasters and for his flaws, as much as for his accomplishment in saving humanity. We'll hear more about Noah a little later this morning, and when we come back, we'll meet our guest, Sarah Bloomfield, director of the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., here on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114. Temple Emmanuel, the largest and fastest-growing Reform congregation in southern Arizona, invites you to become a part of all the wonderful ways we explore Judaism. Are you new in town? Call us for a tour and an information packet. Like to know more about Judaism? From an outstanding preschool program and excellent Reform religious school to the finest adult education academy in the country, Temple Emmanuel offers contemporary Jewish learning with depth, authenticity, and creativity. Try our outreach classes and our hugely popular Taste of Judaism series. And if you're looking for the best Jewish music in town, this is the place. From our string quartet to our Avanim rock band, we include every variety of outstanding Jewish music available. Most importantly, we make Judaism fun and meaningful. Come join us at Temple Emmanuel, 225 North Country Club Road. Call 327-4501 today.
We're delighted to welcome to Too Jewish this morning our guest, Sarah Bloomfield, Executive Director of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. Ms. Bloomfield was the museum's acting director from 1998 to 99 and served as the associate director for museum programs between 94 and 98. Under her leadership, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum has mounted a series of major special exhibits that have garnered popular and scholarly praise, among them the Hidden History of the Kovno Ghetto, the Nazi Olympics Berlin 1936, and Liberation 1945. She launched the museum's traveling exhibit program, which in its first year took four exhibitions to 12 cities across the nation. Ms. Bloomfield joined the staff of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council in 1986 as Deputy Director for Operations, served as Executive Director of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council from 1988 to 94. In that capacity, she played a key role in the creation of the Holocaust Memorial Museum itself, which opened to the public in April of 93. I could go on with her many qualifications. She's been at the Memorial Museum, the Holocaust Museum, for 18 years. Chai, a good number. She's originally from Cleveland, Ohio. We're delighted to welcome Sarah Bloomfield. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here.
When the Holocaust Museum was created, it was something of a revelation, and I believe attendance exceeded all predictions. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think it's a lot of reasons. We've continued to think about that because our attendance has remained high through our entire first decade. I think part of it is certainly to the quality of the institution, how well, and our exhibits, as you may be aware, were very innovative in the museum field. Still, we're a forefront in how to present history to the public, but also that we presented history that is very timely, timeless, universal. It is really a story about, on one level, about Germans and their collaborators and what they did to Jews and others. And on another level, it is a story about what it means to be human, all the good and all the human frailty that is part of the human condition. So it's a very universal story here.
Is the Shoah really a unique event in world history, or is genocide a more broad-based experience?
I'd say yes to both. I mean, all historical events are unique. They never repeat themselves exactly as they occurred before. And certainly, even if you look at other genocides, I don't think there's ever been one where, although Rwanda may come close, where the goal of the state was to kill every, in this case, every last Jew, wherever they could find them. Often they were just killing groups of people for certain political motives, social motives, things like economic motives. So I don't think in that sense there's been a genocide quite like the Holocaust. Certainly, though, there have been genocides in addition to the Holocaust, and even I think today Colin Powell is making the case at the UN that what is going on in Sudan is approaching a genocide. We've seen in the 20th century in Cambodia, Rwanda, ethnic cleansing in Yugoslavia, clearly genocide is a problem for the human race. It's been on every continent, different religious persuasions, political backgrounds. It's a universal problem for humanity.
We will talk much more extensively with Sarah Bloomfield a little later this morning here on Too Jewish.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Sam Kohan of Temple Emmanuel. There's a great little book called Children's Letters to God, Real Letters by Real Kids. A boy writes, "Dear God, how come you did all those miracles in the old days and don't do any now?" Signed, Seymour. When we were young, most of us wondered about that. If God could split the Red Sea, how come he was no help in geometry? If God was so powerful, why didn't we win the lottery? Or why couldn't we make somebody love us? You know, maybe it's that miracles are not quite what we remember them being as kids. There's a prayer in Judaism. We thank you, God, for the daily miracles that happen morning, noon, and night. Come to Temple. Let us help you find the ability to see miracles all around. Call 325-4888. Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson, preschool, religious school, adult education academy. Call 325-4888.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501. We are now pleased and serene to bring you an occasional feature of Too Jewish, Haikus for Jews, which returns from our Zen Judaism department. Yom Kippur, forgive me, Lord, for the Mercedes and all that lobster. Wet moss on the old stones. Lying in the grass, I ponder whom to sue. And the Shiva visit. So sorry about your loss. Now, back to my problems. That was our Zen Judaism segment, Haikus for Jews. To return to our Noah theme this morning, here's a song from a Danny Kaye musical on the story of Noah called Two by Two, based loosely on the Clifford Odets play. It's about what we'll do when the rain stops and humanity can reemerge onto a brand new landscape.
Why are you so gloomy? We're alive and we're afloat. After 40 days and nights, it's shipshape on the boat. Look, the sun's come out again and turned a rosy red. How can you be gloomy when you think of what's ahead? It's gonna be some terrific place when it dries, you're gonna see wide and open space when it dries, it's gonna be some terrific place, you're gonna see wide and open space, we're gonna have such a human race when it dries. The greenery's gonna have a shine when it dries.
When it dries!
The world'll be full and fat and fine when it dries.
When it dries!
The greenery's gonna have a shine. The world'll be full and fat and fine.
The best thing of all, it's one third mine when it dries.
Half a million growing things will spring up from the ground.
Half a million bodies will be floating all around.
Room to work and grow and build a company of men.
Think about how much we can contaminate again.
There's gonna be air beyond compare when it dries.
When it dries.
with drinkable water everywhere.
When it dries, there's gonna be air beyond compare, with drinkable water everywhere.
As long as you don't have people there,
when it dries.
Crickets will chirp, the bees will buzz.
When it dries,
the peaches will wear a fancy buzz.
When it dries,
the crickets will chirp, the bees will buzz. The peaches will wear a fancy buzz.
You're gonna forget how wet it was.
Survive, we'll all live side by side in peace, caring for the animals and watching them increase.
Isn't it a miracle? A brand new world begins.
Think of all the fun we'll have
inventing brand new sins.
We're going to walk a righteous path when it dries. Remembering how he vents his wrath when it dries. We're going to walk a righteous path. Remembering how he vents his wrath.
That when he got mad, we took some bath.
When it dries.
That's Danny Kaye as Noah singing When It Dries from the musical 2x2. And now it's time for our campaign 2004 update. In what some political insiders were calling an attempt to lower expectations in the days leading up to the final presidential debate, the White House announced that President Bush has an IQ of 67. The president is far, far less intelligent than is commonly thought, White House spokesman Scott McClellan told reporters. Even the simplest tasks remain well beyond his reach, reinforcing the impression that the president will be overmatched in the final debate with Senator John Kerry. Mr. McClellan showed reporters never-before-seen footage of Mr. Bush oafishly tumbling from his mountain bike. What a moron, McClellan said. The White House spokesman said that Bush cannot possibly be expected to do well in a debate with Senator Kerry, who Mr. McClellan said has an IQ of 193 and is widely considered the best debater on the planet. But within minutes of the White House press conference, Kerry spokesman Joe Lockhart fired back, telling reporters, "John Kerry is much stupider than he looks." As evidence of Mr. Kerry's idiocy, Mr. Lockhart referred to the floral-patterned windsurfing pants the senator wears while enjoying his favorite water sport. Elsewhere, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said today that it was unfair to compare the upcoming Iraqi elections to those held in America, except for Florida. And that's our campaign 2004 to Jewish update. Our maven on Israel, Danny Bobman, is here today to tell us about Nobel Prizes in Chemistry. Boker Tov, Danny.
Good morning, Rabbi. It's the Nobel Prize again. Yes, sir. Two Israelis, Aaron Chechanover and Avraham Hershko, together with their American colleague Erin Rose, won this year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Their research helped understand how the human body gives the kiss of death to faulty protein to defend itself from disease like cancer. The trio's work already led to the development of numerous drugs for degenerative disease and malignants that big pharmaceutical companies are busy working on. Chechanover is the director of the Rappaport Family Institute for Research in Medical Sciences at the Technion in Haifa, while Hershko, originally from Hungary, is a professor there. This is the first time Israelis received a Nobel Prize for Chemistry, and the third time to win the prize in category other than peace. Last year, Daniel Kelman won the prize in the economy category. Jews in general, and Israel in particular, have a long romance with chemistry. It was Chaim Weizmann, the first president of Israel, and previously one of the leaders of the Zionist movement, who through his research in chemistry became a valuable asset to the British Empire in World War I, and enabled the beginning of the dialogue that led eventually to the Balfour Declaration. That is why the Weizmann Institute, one of the world's leading research institutes, is named after him. On a personal note, my family's history is also tied to chemistry. My grandmother, Gisia, may she rest in peace, immigrated to the U.S. due to her brother's success in developing a substance which later was a critical factor in developing detergents. This brother worked with Dr. Vera Weizmann, Chaim Weizmann's wife, in Russia, and later immigrated to the U.S. As many new immigrants, he wasn't able to resume his scientific career and worked as a janitor in a lab. One night, while attending his cleaning duties, he saw this formula written on the blackboard in one of the lab rooms, and lacking intellectual stimulation, he solved it. The following day, he was caught doing the same to another formula. Apparently, they were looking for the guy who did it all day long. He was approached by one of the professors and asked, was it him that solved the formula? Upon giving his positive response, he learned that they were trying to crack this one for several months and that his solution was a scientific breakthrough. The discovery led to a job offer and money, and the money brought my grandmother's family to Chicago. They named the new chemical Ninol, after my grandmother's young sister, Nina. By the way, my grandma did not stay with the family. She went to Palestine as a tourist after World War I and stayed. But that's another story. Chemistry goes a long way, Rabbi. I'm always amazed at how beyond the harsh realities and the brutality needed for sure survival, somehow the flowers of cutting-edge discoveries still find a way to bloom and make us all so proud. See you next week, Rabbi.
Thanks, Denny. Israelis should feel great and so should Jews everywhere. We'll talk next week. In this 2004 year, the 350th anniversary of North American Judaism, we continue with our weekly Two Jewish American Historical Moment. Last week, we heard the story of the great theatrical teacher Stella Adler. This week, we conclude our journey, which began with Yiddish theater, with a story of another great influence on contemporary actors, the great instructor and actor Lee Strasberg. Paralleling, sometimes joining, and sometimes conflicting with Stella Adler's career was that of Lee Strasberg, born in the Ukraine in 1901. His family emigrated to the United States in 1908. Strasberg lived in the Lower East Side of New York, and as a teenager, he began acting in plays. In 1931, Lee Strasberg joined with Harold Klerman to form the Group Theater in New York. Others involved include Elia Kazan, John Garfield, Howard De Silva, Franco Tone, Clifford Odets, and Lee J. Cobb, and Stella Adler. Members of the group tended to hold left-wing political views and wanted to produce plays that dealt with important social issues in an acting style that reflected personal, emotional motivation. What's my motivation, you might ask? The group theater disbanded in 1941 and Strasberg moved to Hollywood. He came back to Manhattan in 1947, where he joined with Elia Kazan to form and then direct the Actors Studio. Over the next few years, he helped train a number of incredibly successful actors, including Marlon Brando, Rod Steiger, Eli Wallach, Patricia Neal, Dustin Hoffman, and Robert De Niro, and Geraldine Page, Paul Newman, Al Pacino, Marilyn Monroe, Jane Fonda, James Dean, Eli Wallach, Eva Marie Saint, Robert De Niro, Jill Clayburgh, Jack Nicholson, and Steve McQueen. Quite a student body. In 1966, he expanded the Actors Studio to L.A. In 1969, it became the Lee Strasberg Theater Institute in New York and Los Angeles. Lee Strasberg is recognized throughout the world for having produced three generations of actors, playwrights, and directors, and the influence of his teaching continues to flourish today. Strasberg did a bit of acting himself, most notably with his Academy Award-nominated performance in The Godfather Part II as Jewish gangster Hyman Roth, a surrogate for real-life Jewish mobster Meyer Lansky. Lee Strasberg died in 82. Between them, Stella Adler and Lee Strasberg transformed the way great American actors work. Their influence remains profound. And that was our American Jewish historical moment.
We visit weekly with world-renowned chef Janos Wilder of Janos and the J-Bar. Janos, steaks are about the best thing to eat, and Janos might be the best place to eat them.
A lot of people are going out to steakhouses. There are new steakhouses, and we have the very best steaks in all of Tucson. I've got two great steak dishes on the menu. One of them, modestly, of course, I call the truth about meat and potatoes, because that's what it is. It's the best meat and the best potatoes. And then we've got another steak on the menu. It's a New York steak, but you get all the trimmings with it, from the onion rings to the cream spinach to the horseradish mashed potatoes, but you don't get A1 sauce, you get J1 sauce. It all comes with it.
What makes a steak great?
What makes a great steak is, first of all, great aged meat, cooked properly, seasoned properly, and cooked to the absolute perfect temperature.
And that's the way they do it at Janos.
That's right.
What else can you get there?
Well, that's what makes it so fun, because if some of you are steak lovers and some of you aren't, great seafood, shrimp, scallops, salmon, black cod. Right now, we even have soft-shell crabs on the menu.
What's the right number to call to go to Janos or the J-Bar?
615-6100.
We will see you there for a steak. Thanks, Janos.
Thanks, Rabbi.
You can get CDs of any and all past Two Jewish Shows for a nominal fee. Call Temple Emmanuel, 520-327-4501, or visit us on the web at templeemmanueltucson.org. Now it's time for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jack Grossman, a garment salesman on the road, stopped his car on the main street of a small town in rural Alabama. Tired and hungry and unable to find a restaurant, he walked into a general store that sold hardware and farm supplies, but also food. "What can I do for you, sir?" the proprietor asked. "You handle maybe fertilizer?" the Jewish salesman asked. "I sure enough do," the storekeeper replied. "Good," said Grossman. "Go wash your hands and make me a cheese sandwich." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Two Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. Our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, is here this morning to continue talking about terrorism. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've covered how Saudi Arabia has been really a sponsor of extraordinarily non-Western and non-American ideals for quite a while, and yet remains in good graces with the U.S. government. Let's talk about how all that affects Israel.
Well, if Saudi policies were only repressive and anti-Western and anti-democratic at home, it would still be a problem. But because they have a lot of money and are always vying for the leadership of the Arab world, they export these policies and these doctrines. And they
Wahhabism,
sponsor... Well, the Wahhabi sect of Islam is one problem, but they sponsor imams and religious schools and mosque building all over the Muslim world. And they have considerable impact even in non-Arab countries, even in places as far afield as Bosnia. But in the more immediate sense, what concerns us as Jews very often is the security of Israel and our fellow Jews who live there. And there, it's pretty clear that from the very beginning, the Saudi monarchy, the royal family, has been opposed to the creation of a Palestinian state for a number of reasons. You know your history well enough, unlike many of us, to know that in 1948, there could have been a Palestinian state had the Arabs been willing to accept the existence and the creation of a Palestinian state alongside the new Jewish state. They weren't. And one of the reasons they weren't was that behind the scenes, the Saudi royal family was basically paying people to prevent the creation of a Palestinian state. Why? Because the Palestinians, for a very long time, have been among all the Arabs living in the Arab world, the most westernized, the most highly educated, very highly literate, and exposed to Western democracy in many forms, particularly the form in which it exists in Israel, but also in Europe, where many Palestinians go for their education. So the very conservative Saudi royal family, which basically survives by keeping Saudis ignorant, uneducated, unemployed, and living on the dole, it's horribly afraid of seeing a prosperous, well-educated group of democratic Arabs creating a state of their own that might be a success. And every time we get anywhere close to that in any form of the peace process, they intervene in one way or another. They subsidize a terrorist group. They subsidize an attack or a series of attacks. They basically make it more difficult for the two sides to come to agreement. And have maintained a policy of actively, but behind the scenes and covertly, working against the creation of a Palestinian state for at least 50 years. This is something that the U.S. government either hasn't understood or doesn't want to understand, but it's an impediment to peace and to security in the Middle East that must be removed before we can have any realistic hope of succeeding.
So the next target in the war on terror, if there really was such a thing, really should be the Saudi royal family.
That should have been the first target.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week. When we come back, we'll have the next winner of our Two Jewish Stories contest.
Tucson's best-kept secret is out. Handmaker has beautiful new assisted living apartments and suites in addition to in-home care. Known for more than 40 years as Tucson's premier provider of nursing care, Handmaker now offers a variety of choices in assisted living programs, from minimal assistance to extensive services, including memory care, in our home or yours. Need more assistance? Handmaker offers the full spectrum of care and services, including nursing, post-hospital care, and hospice. Our friendship suites, studios, and our one- and two-bedroom apartments all include basic services, meals, on-site and community activities, transportation, and more. Experience the very best in health-related assisted living with Handmaker's team of seasoned, dedicated professionals. Nonprofit, serving all faiths for more than 40 years. Only a few apartments left to choose from, so call 322-7035 for a tour today. That's 322-7035.
Amy Hirschberg Letterman is here with our next winner of the Two Jewish Stories contest. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi. Today we have Sylvia Paley, who grew up in a Jewish community in Brooklyn, New York. She's married to Al Paley for 55 years and has 3 children and 4 grandsons. She loves acting, storytelling, and learning. Above all, she loves being Jewish. Sylvia is going to read her story, My Mother Always Talked to God.
I was born and brought up in a Jewish community in Borough Park, Brooklyn. The community was mostly Orthodox, some people more than others. The shuls were beautiful. We had yeshivas and Talmud Torahs, and all our stores closed on Shabbos. I felt very comfortable in my surroundings. My family could not afford to go to the big shul, so we settled for the small shulas in the neighborhood just for the major holidays. I used to go to the beautiful big shul with my friend and sit in the balcony and listen to the great rabbis and cantors. Their sermons and the sound of their voices stay with me till this day. When the cantor prayed, I felt the prayers went directly to God. My mother always talked to God on a daily basis. She would thank him for his many blessings, and other times she asked for his intervention on behalf of sick members of the family to help in their recovery. It got so that I considered God a member of my family. I too began to speak to him. When I contracted diphtheria and I was very ill, I asked God to help me get better. I made a promise to God. Actually, it was more like a negotiation. I told him that if he helped me get better, I would know that I had a destiny. I promised God that he would not be sorry. I told him that I would be a good citizen and a good Jewish woman. As my health improved, I got better. I felt that my life had purpose, even if I didn't know what it was. I was 12 years old when I made that promise, and I've spent my life fulfilling my end of God's blessing to me. God has been a member of my own family, just as he was for my mother's. I have never felt alone. I always feel that God is with me, and I speak to him often. Someone asked me if God ever answers me. I answered, yep, every day.
Thank you for that beautiful story.
We look forward to hearing more of these great stories. Our Jewish Poetry Slam this week is on the subject of the Ark by the Nobel Prize-winning poet Wisława Szymborska. An endless rain is just beginning. Into the Ark, for where else can you go? Your poems for a single voice, private exaltations, unnecessary talents, surplus curiosity, short-range sorrows and fears, eagerness to see all things from all sides, play for play's sake, and tears of mirth. As far as the eye can see, there's water and a hazy horizon. Into the Ark, plans for the distant future, joy and difference, admiration for the better man, outworn scruples, time to think it over, and the belief that all this will come in handy someday.
For the sake of the children we still are, fairy tales have happy endings. That's the only finale that we'll do here, too. The rain will stop, the waves will subside, the clouds will part in the cleared-up sky, and they'll be once more what clouds overhead ought to be, lofty and rather light-hearted in their likeness to things drying in the sun, isles of bliss, lambs, cauliflowers, diapers. Into the Ark by the poet Wisława Szymborska. When we return, we'll get the news of Jews around the world.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road Office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Anne Frank, the Jewish teenager and diarist who became the symbol of courage for living under Nazi occupation in Amsterdam until being murdered by the Germans late in the war, was never actually a Dutch citizen. But 60 years later, there's a movement to change that. The immigration ministry in the Netherlands is under severe pressure to posthumously award citizenship to the teenager who expressed a wish to be Dutch in her very famous autobiography. A TV station there recently declared her a candidate for the greatest Dutch personality in history. Anne Frank was officially a stateless German Jewish refugee when she hid in that attic in an Amsterdam canal house through 2 years of World War II. Anne Frank ultimately died in Bergen-Belsen concentration camp in 1945, just weeks before the camp was liberated by the British. The country in the Middle East that was always the most dangerous to American interests and which has been sponsoring terrorism on an international scale, that is, Iran, has converted a few tons of raw uranium into hexafluoride gas, which is fed to the centrifuges used to enrich uranium, Hussein Mousavian, Tehran's delegate to the UN watchdog agency, reported last week. This is one step closer to nuclear weapons production. Last Tuesday, Iran announced it was able to launch a missile with a 2,000-kilometer range, capable of hitting Israel and southern Europe. This continued bad news on Iran ultimately has much greater impact than the failing U.S. occupation of Iraq. The Israeli military operation in the Gaza Strip, aimed at stopping Qassam rocket attacks into Israel, continued for a second week. The military action, designed to stop terror attacks in preparation for the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, seems not to be having much effect on the easily transported Qassam rocket launchers. In happier news, as you heard from Danny Bobman, the Nobel Prize for Chemistry was won by two Israelis and an American Jew. This marks the first time the Nobel Chemistry Prize has been awarded to somebody from Israel, although it does mark the 22nd time in its history that Jews have received the Chemistry Prize. The other Israeli Nobel Prizes include the 1978 award to Prime Minister Menachem Begin, who shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. In 1994, Foreign Minister Shimon Peres and Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin shared the Peace Prize with Yasser Arafat. In 1966, Shmuel Yosef Agnon shared the Literature Prize with Swedish Jewish writer Nellie Sachs. Of course, many, many Jews from other countries have won many other Nobel Prizes, from Albert Einstein and Niels Bohr in physics to Saul Bellow in literature to Milton Friedman in economics to Elie Wiesel's Peace Prize to more than half of the prizes in medicine. In Germany, a woman doing handsprings hurled herself into two art installations at a controversial exhibition in Berlin of a collection belonging to the billionaire heir of a Nazi-era arms supplier, damaging both pieces. The bizarre attack last week was on the top floor of the Hamburger Bahnhof Museum, where Friedrich Christian Flick's collection was open to the public earlier in the day. Yelling loudly, the 35-year-old woman attacked Office Baroque, a cutout section of wall by American artist Gordon Matta Clark, doing a series of head-over-heels flips before landing on the work in a handstand, punching both her arms through the drywall, said the president of Berlin's Prussian Cultural Heritage Foundation. Police arrived on the scene 5 minutes later, took the woman into custody. As she was apprehended, the woman said, "Flick, I am satisfied." Controversy has surrounded the exhibit, with many questioning whether it was appropriate to display works from the collection of 2,500 contemporary pieces, given the Flick family's background, which is that after Germany's defeat in World War II, Flick's grandfather, Friedrich Flick, was sentenced to 7 years in prison for crimes that included the use of slave labor in his arms factories and the confiscation of Jewish property. The elder Flick lost his fortune, but after his release was able to rebuild his business in West Germany before his death in 1972 to become the fifth wealthiest man in the world at the time. In sports, running back Matt Bernstein of the University of Wisconsin went to Temple, fasted on Yom Kippur, broke his fast, and then ran for a career-high 123 yards in a victory over Penn State. Mazel tov, Matt.
I mean, that's the story of my life. No respect. I don't get no respect at all. You kidding me? No respect at all.
And Rodney Dangerfield, the bug-eyed comic whose self-deprecating one-liners brought him late stardom in clubs, television, and movies, and made his lament, "I don't get no respect," a catchphrase, died last week. He was 82. As a comic, Dangerfield, clad in a black suit, red tie, and white shirt with a collar that always seemed too tight, convulsed audiences with lines like, "When I was born, I was so ugly, the doctor slapped my mother. And every time I get in an elevator, the operator says the same thing to me. Basement?" He explained the origin of his respect trademark. "I had this joke. I played hide and seek. They wouldn't even look for me. To make it work better, you look for something to put in front of it. I was so poor, I was so dumb, so this, so that, I thought, now what fits that joke? Well, no one liked me was all right, but then I thought a more profound thing would be, I get no respect." Dangerfield tried it at a New York club, and the joke drew a bigger response. He kept the phrase in the act, and it seemed to establish a bond with his audience. After hearing him perform years later, Jack Benny remarked, "Me, I get laughs because I'm cheap and 39. Your image goes into the soul of everyone." Dangerfield, born Jacob Cohen, had a strange career in show business. At 19, he started as a stand-up comedian and a singing waiter. He appeared in rundown joints and tried out jokes at a resort in the Catskills, the training ground for Danny Kaye, Jerry Lewis, Sid Caesar, and most other Jewish comedians. The job paid $12 a week, plus room and meals. In New York City, to make a living, he drove a truck. Married at 27, he decided he couldn't support a family on his meager earnings and instead went to work as an aluminum siding salesman, settling down in suburban Jersey. And then at age 42, he came back to show business. He didn't want to break in his new act with any notice, so he asked the owner of a New York club not to bill him with his real name. His bookings improved, he landed television gigs. After his ex-wife died, he took over the responsibility of raising his two kids, decided to quit touring, and opened a New York nightclub, Dangerfield, so he could stay close to home. A beer commercial and 70 appearances on Johnny Carson's The Tonight Show brought him national attention. After his first major film role in Caddyshack, Dangerfield began starring in his own movies, which he sometimes wrote, like Easy Money, Back to School, and The Scout. He turned dramatic as a sadistic father in Oliver Stone's 1994 Natural Born Killers. In 1995, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences rejected Dangerfield's application for membership. A letter from Roddy McDowell of the Actors Branch explained that the comedian had failed to execute enough of the kinds of roles that allow a performer to demonstrate the mastery of his craft. It was the ultimate rejection, and Dangerfield played it to the hilt. The public reaction prompted the Academy to reverse itself and offer membership. Dangerfield declined. "They don't even apologize or nothing," he said. "They give no respect at all," pardon the pun, "to comedy." Rodney's famous trademark white shirt and red tie are on permanent display at the Smithsonian. Finally, he's getting a little respect. Among his best lines were, "Once when I was lost, I saw a policeman and asked him to help me find my parents. I said to him, 'You think we'll ever find them?' He said, 'I don't know, kid. There's so many places they can hide.' And my wife and I were happy for 20 years. Then we met." "When I was a kid, I got no respect," said Dangerfield. "The time I was kidnapped, the kidnapper sent my parents a note that said, 'We want $5,000 or you'll see your kid again.' Well, we won't see him anymore. Now in passing, Jacob Cohen, or Rodney Dangerfield, gets that respect." That's the news of Jews around the world.
Our brothers, the halls of Israel.
We welcome back to Two Jewish Sarah Bloomfield, Executive Director of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. She was the acting director before becoming the permanent director, a position she has now held since 1999. Ms. Bloomfield's originally from Cleveland, Ohio, where she was a vice president of financial group and has now worked in developing the museum's extensive collection and an exhibit schedule to a level of world renown. Before it was created, she worked with the Office of Management and Budget in the U.S. Congress, which led to the creation of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. Welcome back, Sarah.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
For visitors to the Holocaust Museum, the experience can be overwhelming. It's very involving and a very different approach to museums. Do many people come back repeatedly?
That's a really interesting question, because when we were working on the creation of the museum, we assumed that given how powerful and difficult the history is, most people would think it's just a place you go once. But we were very wrong. People do come back. We have about 20% repeat visitation.
On college campuses today, by far the most popular courses in Judaic studies are Holocaust classes. That's been true for quite a while. Is that a good thing?
Well, obviously, I've devoted my life to teaching people the history and the lessons of the Holocaust. So I think the more that people are studying this, you can't think about your present and future as citizens, responsible citizens of what we understand now as a very interdependent world with a lot of benefits and a lot of dangers, without understanding history.
What is the cutting-edge research being done in Holocaust studies today?
A couple of things. One was that the early years tended to focus a lot on what's called the center of decision-making, what was emanating out of Berlin and the kind of the leadership under Hitler.
The Wannsee Conference.
Yes, right. The top-ranking Nazis. And another that we have been heavily involved in is balancing the research, not so much on the side of the perpetrators, after the war, because the Nazis left, you know, millions and millions of pages of documentation, the scholars that began studying this, as scholars do, they went right to the archival collections, and so they wrote the history of the Holocaust from the perspective of the perpetrators. Most people assumed that all Jewish documentation had been destroyed during the Holocaust, but the event happened both by the perpetrators and it happened to the victims, and the victims obviously responded in various ways, based on who they were as a people, religiously, historically, culturally. And it turns out that there is, in fact, more documentation from the Jewish side than people previously thought. So we are trying to heavily encourage the collection of archival materials from Jewish communities and Jewish organizations and individuals so that scholars can begin to look at the Holocaust also from the perspective of the victims.
And the notion of the sort of greater autonomy brings me to Daniel Jonah Goldhagen's book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, and the great controversy that created in Holocaust studies, saying that it wasn't quite as top-down as everybody seemed to think. Has that influenced the work?
Well, his point was also slightly different. He made the point you made, but he also said that there was a certain kind of eliminationist anti-Semitism in Germany.
Right.
And I would say most scholars, if you look at the people who collaborated with the Nazis in most of these local communities, they weren't just Germans. They were Croatians,
Ukrainians, Poles,
Latvians, Lithuanians. So it's hard to make a case that German anti-Semitism was unique. There's just enormous representation from local collaborators in the killing process, the Romanians, the Hungarians. I mean, I could go on and on. So I would say most scholars do not find that theory holds up when you look at the Holocaust in its totality.
You were chosen to shift a little bit. You were chosen director of the Holocaust Museum after a period of controversy and leadership, although you've been at the museum throughout its history. It must have been a challenging time. How did you approach the problem?
You know, I'm very privileged to work here. It's an extraordinary institution. I feel just blessed to be a part of it. And all important institutions are complicated, and they have their problems. For me,
even unimportant institutions are complicated,
yes,
too.
So. That may be true, but I've always said to myself, if you want to have a simple life, you know, go work at a simple institute. You know, this is a big and complex place.
Right.
And what has always sustained me is staying focused on the mission, about why I'm here. And thinking about that this is really, at its heart, a memorial. That's what it is, first and foremost.
I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit. The Holocaust Museum is unique on the Mall in Washington, D.C. What does it say that the Holocaust Museum was created before there was a World War II monument?
Yeah, I don't. I know there's a long history to the World War II memorial, and I don't know why it took so long to build that. I really haven't followed that process about what happened in Congress. One would have thought, given the importance of World War II to our country, that that would have happened sooner. I know there were some issues in it being brought before Congress in earlier times, but I really don't, frankly, know the whole history.
And I guess there was an implied question there. The other museums and monuments, memorials on the Mall, are essentially American monuments. The Holocaust Museum is really an international monument, an international entity. Why was it sort of the first one and maybe the only one really there now?
Well, actually, I don't think I would agree with exactly how you phrased the question. I think the Smithsonian certainly sees themselves very much as we do, as they have huge international visitation as well, and as being a place, as well as the National Gallery, being a place that, like we do, that speaks about human history and humanity's achievements. And the museum, in a way, our museum, stands in a very stark counterpoint to the rest of the Mall, where the Smithsonian speaks to man's great achievements in science, in history, in art, and culture. We have the Washington and Jefferson Memorials flanking our museum, speaks to man's great promise about human freedom and dignity. And then we stand here reminding people that human beings have another side, the darker side. And I think that contrast really has made the Mall a very important and very interesting place.
A little bit broader question. The Holocaust Museum is now focusing on the genocide in the Sudan in the Darfur region. Why is there so little attention? Why has so little attention been paid to this till now?
Well, for the same reasons it always is. It is, you know, people ask, well, in whose interest is it to pay attention to this? I mean, the civil war has been going on in the Sudan for, I think it's 18 years now. So from time to time, there have been moments when it comes to the forefront of everybody's agenda. And then actually, frankly, it was several years ago a big item. It went away for a few years. There actually seemed to be some progress in the Civil War. The war on terrorism came up. Sudan was being helpful. Now this new issue has come up. I will say, I think to my great surprise, is that the Sudan problem has been given more attention than I would have thought. Although, you know, there's a line in Claude Lanzmann's brilliant film Shoah, where a Polish peasant who lived right near Auschwitz and had literally the ash from the crematoria dropping in his farmland, and he was asked by Lanzmann, did it bother him when that happened, when Jews were being killed right in his backyard? And his answer was, when I cut my finger, I feel it, and when you cut your finger, you feel it. That's a problem for humanity.
Hmm. Well, helping us to understand that when someone else cuts our finger, we should feel it too. I want to thank Sarah Bloomfield for a great visit here on To Jewish. Thank you, Sarah.
Great. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Sam Kohan of Temple Emmanuel. A great rabbi, Hananya, said that when two people sit together and learn, God's presence is always there. Learning in Judaism leads to holiness. When you seek wisdom, try with a friend to find out more about your heritage and what truly matters. You make your own life holy. If you want something more out of life, you have to stretch just a little to learn. What do you want? Do you want to know more, understand better? Do you want those same things for your kids? Give your children the chance to know their heritage, their people, and their God. Take that chance for yourself. You too can bring something sacred to your life and your family. Call 325-4888 for Temple Emmanuel, preschool, religious school, adult education academy, Jewish learning for life. Temple Emmanuel, 325-4888.
Thanks for being here with us on Too Jewish this morning. Join us next week when our guest will be the most unusual Jewish rap star, 50 Shekel. By all means, come back next Sunday morning for Too Jewish on KVOI 690 AM at 9 o'clock. Our playout this morning comes from the enjoyable music of the Jews of Uganda, the Abu Yudaya, a song called God Creates and Then Destroys. A perfect explanation for a lot of what happens in the early stages of Genesis, which we've been reading. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
Yumba umba umene gaina gaumbula yumba umba wangesimanyira ngandifira Urumbira mani babo genda ngalo kulondirira urumbira mani wangesimanyira ngabalindanya
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.